It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, researchers at Northland College in Ashland have made a surprising discovery about flying squirrels. They turn bright pink in ultraviolet light. One of the researchers joins the show to tell us about the biological mystery. First, about 93.3 million U.S. adults live with obesity, according to recent data from the Centers for Disease Control. That comes with a price in terms of health risks and medical costs, and it takes an emotional toll, too. Our next guest joins to share his personal story of obesity. Tommy Tomlinson is the host of the Southbound podcast and author of the new book, The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. He joins us from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Tommy, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, how you doing?
Well, good. Now, you write early on in your book, Tommy, you write, "I weigh 460 pounds. These are the hardest words I've ever had to write." Why is this hard to talk about and to write about?
Well, in the specifics for me, that was a secret I never told anyone. My family didn't know. My wife didn't know. Nobody knew that number but me. And so to put it in concrete and to write it down was like almost like confessing the crime for me. But I think beyond that, the bigger picture is it's hard for anybody who's seriously overweight to talk about their problem. It's a problem that everybody sees, you know, externally. Our addiction is different than others in that anybody can see what our problem is. But it's a very difficult thing to talk about because I think a lot of people think it can be battled by simply eating less and exercising. And there are a lot more factors that go into it. And that's what makes it difficult.
I want to talk about one of those factors in particular, the idea that, I mean, a lot of us, obese or not, think of the idea of comfort food. We turn to food for solace in a stressful situation. In the case of someone like you dealing with obesity can cause that stress and that difficulty leading you to eat the foods that are comfortable. And it's a vicious circle in some ways, right?
Right. And it catches you on both ends. When you've had a really good day or you want to celebrate, the way many people celebrate is by having a good meal. And that's what you do with friends, that sort of fellowship and camaraderie. But then on the other end, as you mentioned, when you've had a bad day, that's the kind of time when people tend to, you know, go in the freezer at night and get out the ice cream and just, you know, eat it right out of the carton. And it does. It creates this cycle where, you know, the worse you feel, the worse you eat, and that makes you feel worse, and that makes you eat worse. And so it really does kind of create this feedback loop that for many of us can be really hard to get out of.
And you mentioned this is, unlike a lot of problems people might deal with, this is something, obesity is something that everybody else can see. Do you feel, I guess, like a moral or ethical judgment coming from people?
Not as much as it happened like when I was a kid. But certainly I still do feel that. I hear a remark every once in a while on the street or something. When I was a columnist at the Charlotte Observer, which I was for about 15 years, people would write in if they were upset with something I wrote. Some of them would have constructive criticism or whatever I wrote about. Other people would write in and say, you know, you can't control this one big thing in your life. How dare you judge somebody else? And so they would use my weight as sort of leverage to sort of criticize me without actually engaging with what I was saying at the moment. So, yeah, I've heard it one way or the other, this sort of moral judgment off and on my whole life.
Talking to Tommy Tomlinson about his new book, The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. You give us some insight right off the bat in the book about kind of how you have to case a room in some ways to deal with it, to make sure you'll have a place to sit. Can you talk us through some of the things you're observing and figuring out on a daily basis?
I think about it like Tony Soprano, you know, trying to go into a room and figuring out where the danger spots are. For me, it's something like if there's a booth and the table is fixed, like it doesn't move back and forth, then the booth is often hard for a guy like me to squeeze into. If there's a counter, like a bar or a counter or something, the bar stools, if they're bolted to the floor, it's hard for me to adjust for me and to get in there. Tables are best, but even then, tables can be fraught, too, if the chairs are rickety or if the arms are really narrow. And so a big part of my kind of daily life when I'm going to an unfamiliar place is scouting it out. And often I describe a scene in the book where I'm having breakfast with a friend. I will look it up the night before on Google and sort of scout the interior to try to find a comfortable place.
Can you talk? You mentioned being a kid and already dealing with issues of being overweight. Can you talk about some of your story of your childhood?
Sure. I grew up in a big Southern family, very traditional. We ate, you know, all the stuff that you think about with Southern food, a lot of fried chicken, a lot of cornbread and biscuits and pecan pie and all that sort of thing. But something that happened in our family is certainly not unique to the South. I think it's happened in many families, and is one reason America has gotten so much bigger, is that there was a cultural shift from blue-collar work to white-collar work. My mom and dad worked in cotton fields when they were teenagers and even younger. By the time I came around, they were working basically factory jobs. But everybody through their generation and my family worked with their backs and their hands. They worked very, very hard so that I didn't have to. And so by the time I came along, I was able to go to college, find journalism, which is basically a desk job for my whole life. But that whole time we were eating those same big Southern meals. My mom and dad and the people of their generation used those meals for fuel because they were going to go to work that day and burn them all off. I didn't get to burn all the meals off. And so while they stayed the same size, I got bigger.
And at the same time, that was changing to this sedentary lifestyle. You mentioned that we've really gotten to this situation where that kind of food isn't just available when the family cooks it. We have access to that fatty, salty, high-calorie food every block or two.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in a city or even in a small town, you can't go more than a couple of blocks without running into fast food, junk food, convenience store, drive-through, a pizza joint, something like that. Most of these foods are terrible for you. And they're also extremely tasty and addictive. And so, you know, McDonald's has spent literally billions of dollars making their food taste so good that you keep coming back. And so if faced against those obstacles, it's very difficult for people who have a propensity to overeat to stop from that, because everywhere you turn, it's there. You know, the movie theater nearest to our house, the one that we go to the most often, if you order a small Coke, it's 32 ounces. You know, a small bottle of Coke back in when I was a kid was like 6.5 ounces. So now it's basically a small drink is 5 times bigger than it used to be. And that's one big reason that most of us have gotten bigger as well.
And you have recently tried to lose weight, but this isn't the first time. Your first diet plan, you write, was as an 11-year-old, pills, a prescription from a doctor. Can you talk about those first efforts?
Sure. My mom took me to a diet doctor when I was 11, 12 years old. He gave me what I know now are basically amphetamines, which actually gave me much more stamina playing basketball all day, but did not seem to do much for my appetite. I still had a big appetite. Later on, I tried these, you know, there were like diet candies. I remember the first time carbohydrates were considered bad for you. And then several cycles after that where they were considered good for you. And so pretty much every big diet of the last 30 or 40 years you can name, I've tried it. And what I've learned over the years is that if you have 10 pounds to lose, you could probably try one of those diets and it'll work. But if you have 200 pounds to lose, the how is never enough. You have to start talking about the why you got that big in the first place, and that's a big part of what my book is about.
We're talking to Tommy Tomlinson. His new book is a memoir about obesity. It's called The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this your story too? Have you dealt with being overweight or obese? What has it meant for your life, for your health? How about the emotional toll? And you have a question for our guest about his own experience? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Tommy Tomlinson, author of the book, The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you overweight or obese? Have you tried to work to lose weight? What do you see when you go out in public? What do you hear from people? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Tommy, before we go to our callers, throughout the book, you talk about basically a year's worth of efforts to try to lose weight and stay, keep that weight off. Can you talk about what that experience has been like and what you've done?
Well, I've tried many, many things, you know, Overeaters Anonymous, Weight Watchers, many, many different types of diets. I decided that for me, most of those are designed and work best in the short term. Lots of people want to lose weight really fast. And it's not, you know, as my doctor says, 91% of the people who lose weight on crash diets or any sort of quick program gain it all back. And so what I've set out to do is to lose weight very slowly. I just do kind of a calories in, calories out count every day. If as long as I burn more than I eat, I consider that a win. And over the last few years, I have managed to lose weight slowly and steadily and sort of fooled my body into not knowing that I'm actually on a diet plan, because your body wants to peg you back at whatever your highest weight was, because as you lose weight, it thinks you're starving. And so it slows down your metabolism often to try to push you back toward what you were. So even sometimes our own bodies are fighting against us when we try to lose weight.
Let's go to our callers now. Deborah is with us in Brown Deer. Hello.
Hi, Rob and Tommy. I have a friend who is just an exceptional human being. She's beautiful. She's just gone above and beyond the call of duty of helping my sister. And I want to know, how do I or anybody else help her to lose weight? She's very overweight. And I know she'd be happier I'm thinner. I just know it. And I wonder, how do I do that? Because she's so exceptional, I want her to be happy. And how would I, what's the best way to help somebody? I don't want to offend her. So how would I help her?
So can a well-meaning friend help out, Tommy?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things. First of all, understand that she is maybe just as baffled by her inability to lose weight as you are. It took me, I'm 55 now, and it really did take me 50 years or more to figure out why I had gained so much weight in the first place, or at the very least to start figuring it out. So there are issues in her life, you know, things that maybe are from her childhood or just other things that she hasn't been able to solve that cause her to lose weight. And it caused her to gain weight. And I see this all the time in the person you described. They're very successful, happy, kind, loving in the rest of their lives, but they have this one thing that's a puzzle to them that they've never been able to solve. That's very common. I always felt that way. I had a lovely wife, still do, a great family, a great career, but this was this one hurdle I couldn't get over. So I would say, as somebody who's been on the receiving end of this advice, is that you start with love, and you start by talking about other things. That person doesn't want to talk about their weight all the time. So talk about it in the context of other conversations about other things. And then say, don't take them, here's the latest diet I saw in the paper, or here's this book I read or whatever. Just say, you know, talk to them about themselves and the hurdles they see in their lives, the issues they see in their lives, because that to me, more than the how, that why of figuring out why they may have gained so much weight in the first place, that's the key. And if you can help them understand themselves a little better by being a good friend, then that starts them on the path to figuring out the how. Once you figure out the why, the how is not nearly as difficult.
Thanks for the call. Going out to Jerry in the Green Bay area. Jerry, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about Jerry?
Great program, guys. I just totally agree with your guest today. The why, very important, but I'm 55 years old currently now. I used to be a bodybuilder, power lifter, competitively doing that. And I've worked out this whole time since high school. And I have found out that looking at a lot of people and just kind of studying people, that diet is so important. You know, working out is pretty important. I mean, it gets your metabolism going and everything, but I would have to say diet is about 90%. What you eat and how you eat it is so important to keeping that weight off, especially as we get older. It just gets harder. And I'm just kind of a little, I guess you would say, pissed off or mad at, you know, our professionals today that really don't stress that. You know, it is. It's a hard thing to do because food, you know, food is our thing that we love to do. You know, we love to eat, but it's so important. You know, we go to college and we make all this money because of, you know, how we study and everything, but we forget about our bodies. And I think it's probably just as important because as we get older, it becomes very hard, you know, on us and everybody I run into that has bad health that, wow,
Jerry,
I'm
going to jump in, Jerry. Thanks a lot for the call. Tommy, your thoughts on what Jerry had to say?
Well, I think he's exactly right about exercise versus diet. You know, many, many studies have shown this, that exercise will help you live longer. It will make you feel better. It will brighten your mood. It will do a lot of things for you. The one thing it is not really good at is helping you lose weight, which seems counterintuitive, but I'll give a quick example. You would have to walk about 2.5 miles. The average person would have to walk about 2.5 miles to burn off one Snickers bar. So, you know, if you think about an average big meal, you know, like a Friday night fish fry or something like that, to burn off that meal, you'd have to walk halfway across the country or something. And so diet is the key. And that's hard for a lot of people who spend a lot of the time at the gym to get past, but it is, that's the truth. And in fact, many studies have shown that people who don't exercise lose weight just as fast or sometimes faster as people who do. The other part of it that he talked about that I think is really important is that idea of food being sort of this celebratory thing, this family thing. In many ways, food is our last acceptable vice. You know, you get looked down on if you smoke, you get looked down on if you drink too much, you get looked down on for many other habits that 30 or 40 years ago would have been considered perfectly acceptable. But a big meal is not only considered acceptable, it's encouraged. And in many families, including mine, it carried this great symbolic weight with it, and that it was a gift that your family was giving you. And to not indulge in that gift fully, and sometimes overindulge in it, was considered, you know, in some ways kind of a rejection of the gift. And so those are very difficult emotional waters to navigate for most of us.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Tommy Tomlinson. His new book is The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. In the book, Tommy, you talked about some fear of losing weight, some sense that, okay, maybe the weight is part of your identity and you're going to lose a part of yourself. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I know it sounds weird, but I've never been anything but overweight. So I don't know any other version of myself. And I do have some worries that, you know, the person I have to become to lose this weight will not be as likable or enjoyable to be around as the person I am now. Because I don't mean to brag about this, but I do think people generally like me and like being around me. So I worry about becoming a different person. But I have to say, at some level, that doesn't matter so much. Because if I continue to be the same person I was at the beginning of the book, I wasn't going to be around much longer to find out what kind of person I would become. I was, as you said, I was 460 pounds at the beginning of the book, and I was 50 years old. And as I wrote in the book, guys like me don't make it to 60 without changing. And so, you know, regardless of who I turn out to be, I would rather be that than not be here. And so it's been a ongoing experiment as I've lost weight to kind of do a little personality check. So far, I like the person I'm becoming. My wife says I'm more lighthearted now. That's not the only part that's lighter, but it's the important part.
I want to get into your life apart from being overweight, because that's an important part of what you write about. People might look at you and see the one thing, but you say, apart from this one thing, you're pretty happy. You've had a good career. You're married to a woman with family from Wisconsin. That's a good thing. There's a lot of happy parts of your life, too. You're not just this one thing.
Yeah, my wife, Alex Felsing, is from Manitowoc, and she still has lots of family in Racine, Kenosha, that area. So hello to everybody there. Yeah, I have always had these sort of two lives. The life where I've had a successful career as a journalist, I've had loving family, a great wife, good friends, all those sorts of things. And then this other life as this sort of miserable fat person where I could just not figure out how to reconcile those two people. And as you'll see if you read the book, I start figuring out why that big person got to be that way, and started to sort of unlock some of those things. And it helped, you know, in some ways make those two people one person. And that has been a huge key to me moving forward.
In our last few moments, Tommy, this is something, obesity, that everybody's going through in some ways alone, but millions of people are doing this in this country. Are you hoping that just by talking about it, you're going to help people sort of confront and tackle these issues a little more head on?
Yes, I think that many of us, I know I certainly felt like I wanted to and needed to tackle this stuff alone, that nobody would understand the cobwebs in my head or whatever. But you're right. As you walk around and you see other overweight people, yeah, there's a lot of people thinking those same things and feeling those same things. And I think the more that we can talk about it and find some common ground and realize it's not just us, it's not just this craziness in our head. It's the kind of thing that goes through many people's heads, and in fact goes through many people's heads who aren't overweight but are dealing with something else. We all have something. And I think that the more we could talk about what that something is, the more we'll find that the patterns are a lot more common than we thought.
Tommy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I really appreciate it.
That's Tommy Tomlinson, host of the Southbound podcast. He joined us from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. We've been talking about his memoir. It's called The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to the Wisconsin researcher about the recent discovery that flying squirrels here in the state and elsewhere glow pink under UV light. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. The former acting head of the FBI says there was some talk about invoking the 25th Amendment to remove President Trump from office. We'll look at the fallout from Andrew McCabe's 60 Minutes interview coming up. First, researchers at Northland College in Ashland have made a surprising discovery about flying squirrels. In ultraviolet light, the animals turn a bright fluorescent pink. What started as a chance encounter in a Bayfield County forest turned into an investigation about how widespread the trait is and why these squirrels might be glowing pink in the first place. A study sharing what we know so far was recently published in the Journal of Mammalogy. Paula Anich is an associate professor of natural resources at Northland College and was the lead author on this study. Paula, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me to speak to you, Rob.
Well, how did these glowing pink squirrels first get brought to your attention?
Well, one of my colleagues at Northland College, our forestry professor, as a matter of fact, John Martin, was conducting a nighttime survey for fluorescent plants and lichens and fungi that live in the forest canopies way up here in northern Wisconsin. And he happened to catch a flying squirrel in his UV flashlight beam, and it was bright pink in the UV light, which was a surprise. He shared this discovery with Professor Eric Olson at Northland, who's our wildlife professor, then Allison Kohler, who was a senior undergraduate student and a biology major, and with me. So my research is focused on rodents, and flying squirrels are rodents. And then we had to figure out what to do next. It was such a surprising discovery. We tried to figure out whether this was maybe just one very unique individual, whether it's a very local phenomenon in our population of squirrels. Up here in Bayfield County, is this a unique species trait, or is this a unique property of all squirrels that hadn't been described yet?
And this is in the ultraviolet range. They're glowing, but our feeble human eyes can't detect it without a little help, right?
Well, yeah, so we think this is only a trait, this pink is only a trait that is apparent under ultraviolet light. So ultraviolet fluorescence occurs when a substance, so in this case a substance in the flying squirrel's fur, absorbs short wavelength ultraviolet light, and we can't see that short wavelength ultraviolet light. But the substance in the fur absorbs that light and re-emits a longer wavelength. In this case, it re-emits a wavelength that's pinkish to our eyes. So we can see this longer wavelength, and we see it as pink. But it is related to the presence of a really intense beam of ultraviolet light, again, which is too small, too short for us to see.
I see. Now, is this something that you've seen in other animals, like other species?
Ultraviolet fluorescence has been detected in, you know, many groups in recent years. You know, there's a lot of research on ultraviolet fluorescence in bird species, and it seems like many birds have ultraviolet fluorescence. So, and in many cases, it seems to be a feature of the plumage that it relates to mate choice. So the more fluorescent individuals seem to have a reproductive advantage. There are also frogs that demonstrate fluorescence, and chameleons that demonstrate fluorescence, and sea turtles and fishes that demonstrate fluorescence, too. When we were reviewing the literature, the only mammals that we came across that had UV fluorescence were New World opossums. So the Virginia opossum, for instance, is UV fluorescent, and many of its relatives that live in Central and South America also demonstrate ultraviolet fluorescence. But this was the first instance of a non-marsupial fluorescing that we were aware of.
So picking up the thread, you wanted to figure out, is it just this one shiny dude, or
yeah,
is it all of that species in the area, or are there other species? So what did you do next, and what did you find out?
Well, we did some detective work at some large zoological museum collections. So Allison went to the Science Museum of Minnesota in St. Paul, and she looked at more individual flying squirrels that were collected from the Great Lakes region, and she looked at some of the squirrels that you and I are more familiar with seeing, like gray squirrels and fox squirrels and red squirrels, squirrels that are active during the daytime, also from the Great Lakes region. And she looked at these Great Lakes daytime active squirrels and the nocturnal flying squirrels under visible light and UV light, and she found that only the flying squirrels from the Great Lakes region were fluorescent, and all of those daytime active squirrels were not fluorescent at all. So that supported the idea that the flying squirrel that Professor Martin saw in Bayfield County wasn't unique. It was showing a similar pattern to other individuals of its species in this area. And the second flying squirrel species that we have in this area, in the Great Lakes, we have northern and southern flying squirrels. And then from there, we decided we had to test even more broadly. So we went to the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, and then we really systematically tried to sample all three of the North American flying squirrels, northern flying squirrels, southern flying squirrels, and Humboldt's flying squirrels, which lives on the Pacific coast. And we sampled as many populations from Canada to Guatemala, which is the southern range limit of the southern flying squirrel. And for as many locations as we could, we sampled males and females. We sampled species from many different species and populations from many different habitat types, from many different forest types, from many different elevational levels. And then the results from the Field Museum showed that 108 out of 109 sampled flying squirrels fluoresced. So in the end, we found that it was present in males and females from all seasons, from over 100 years of collecting, from Guatemala all the way up until Canada. So it seems like this is a property of the flying squirrels in general that inhabit the Americas.
Talking to Paula Anich, she's a professor of natural resources at Northland College in Ashland, talking about these flying squirrels that glow pink under ultraviolet light. So Paula, if I'm a flying squirrel, what's in it for me? Why do I want to glow pink in ultraviolet light?
So we don't know yet, and I actually think that's really exciting. I think this whole study has been a reminder that not all animals interact with their environment or perceive their environment the way we do as humans. And there's so much more to learn about nocturnal mammals. I think one of the things that's very interesting about the pattern that we see in flying squirrels, where they're bright pink below, is that they're showing the same pattern of ultraviolet fluorescence as many species of owls that inhabit the same forests. So our North American flying squirrels inhabit forests because they glide from tree to tree on these big furry membranes that extend from their wrists to their ankles. And the same forests that they use in the Americas are occupied by great horned owls and barred owls and northern sawwood owls and screech owls and many species of owls that also have a bright pink ultraviolet fluorescence on their bellies and on the undersides of their wings. So our forests are full of a lot of animals, mammalian and avian, that are bright pink underneath in the presence of ultraviolet light.
So who else is going to see this? Because, again, it's only in the presence of ultraviolet light. Is this something that comes up a lot if you're bipping around from tree to tree?
Well, it seems like ultraviolet light is present during the day. But at dawn and dusk in particular, or during twilight, ultraviolet wavelengths are a little more abundant than some of the other wavelengths of light. So ultraviolet radiation is more abundant, and it's potentially more important for animals that are active at dawn and dusk. But that's a hypothesis that we're investigating a bit more.
Interesting. So now how do you try to sort this out, the function, I guess, of this glowing? What kind of things do you do to try to figure this out?
Well, I think that more field-based research is going to be really important to try to figure out how this pattern and how variation in fluorescence influences interactions among individuals in wild populations. I'm interested in exploring the variation of this trait in populations a little bit more to try to see if there are any patterns that we can just discern about whether or not it's related to age, whether it changes over time, whether there's subtle change between seasons. At this point, it was so ubiquitous, there wasn't a pattern that jumped out at us right away, but we're going to continue to do more research into this.
And any quick maybe notions at this point of why this might be there? I know we're not even necessarily at the hypothesis stage, but what ideas are people throwing out there?
I strongly think that this is related to how important ultraviolet light is at twilight and overnight, and I think it's related to adaptations for this sort of nocturnal realm. I keep thinking about how the possums, the opossums that have this same kind of fluorescent, are also active at the same times of night and dawn and dusk. So I think there's a whole like unique suite of adaptations to perceiving and communicating at dawn and dusk that the flying squirrels and other mammalian groups are using.
It's really interesting. I'm really curious now to find out what's up with this.
Yeah, it's so darn cool. I've been studying rodents for almost two decades now, and I've never been involved in a project where the result was kind of so inconclusive. Like, we really don't know what this means, and yet it's captured the public imagination to kind of an unprecedented degree. So everyone's excited that squirrels are pink, and at this point, we don't really know what it's getting, what it's doing for them. So it's exciting. I'm glad it's making everybody out there appreciate rodents.
We'll leave it there for now. Paula, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rob.
Paula Anich is an associate professor of natural resources at Northland College in Ashland. She talked to us about the recent discovery in northern Wisconsin that flying squirrels have a bright pinkish glow under ultraviolet light. Coming up, a top U.S. senator is pledging an investigation into what he calls an administrative coup against President Trump. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, politicians and consumers have raised concerns about the high cost of prescription medications, but our guest says one effort to cut those costs is raising safety concerns. First, there's a lot of fallout today over comments made by a past FBI chief about the use of a procedural move to remove President Trump from office. In an interview that aired last night on 60 Minutes, former acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe said he very briefly discussed invoking the 25th Amendment with Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein.
Discussion of the 25th Amendment was simply Rod raised the issue and discussed it with me in the context of thinking about how many other cabinet officials might support such an effort.
McCabe said he personally didn't have much to contribute to that conversation, so he just listened. He said Rosenstein was very concerned about Trump and his capacity and intent. McCabe also shed light on what prompted him to launch obstruction of justice and counterintelligence probes related to the president. Brian Kalt is a law professor and the Harold Norris Faculty Scholar at Michigan State University. He's the author of Constitutional Cliffhangers, A Legal Guide for Presidents and Their Enemies. Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Well, this 25th Amendment comment has got a lot of reaction. We're going to dig into what the 25th Amendment actually says and what it actually does. But what's your reaction to this moment out of that 60 Minutes interview?
Well, to me, it seems a little sensationalistic because nothing really happened. But it is admittedly remarkable to have people inside the administration even talking about it. I just don't think that the discussions went very far. I think if they had said, well, there were a lot of people and they considered it and rejected it or something like that. But as someone who studies this stuff, I think always good to bring some attention to it so people can understand it better.
Right. Let's talk about the 25th Amendment. It has multiple parts. Some of it is just if you got no president, the vice president steps in, some pretty basic stuff. Talk a little bit about the removal of the president by the cabinet part. What actually would have to happen?
Sure. So that's in Section 4. So actually the only part of the amendment that's never been used. If the vice president and a majority of the cabinet declare that the president is, quote, unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, unquote, then the president is temporarily removed from power. He's still the president, but his powers are transferred to the vice president. Then whenever the president says that he's just fine, one of two things happens. Either the vice president and cabinet agree, and the president takes his power back after a few days, or if they disagree, then it goes to Congress for a vote. And you need two-thirds in the House and two-thirds in the Senate to agree that the president is unable. Otherwise, the president takes his power back. So it's the deck is stacked in favor of any president who's able to respond. It makes it very difficult to remove power from someone in that situation, which is what we would have been dealing with here if they had invoked it on Trump. He certainly would have said that he was fine and sent the issue to Congress.
You said who is able to respond, a president who's able to respond. What was the intent of this part of the 25th Amendment?
So the idea was we'd had situations, Woodrow Wilson had his stroke, President Garfield was shot, where we had these long stretches where the president couldn't do his job. And the problem was the Constitution said the vice president is supposed to step in, but it didn't give us a process for that. And it also didn't make clear that if the president recovered, that the president would be able to come back. And because of the lack of a process, because of this possibility that the president wouldn't be able to come back, vice presidents were very reluctant to step up. And so what Section 4 was meant to do was to provide that process and make clear that it would be temporary so that if the president was completely incapacitated in a coma or missing or something like that, that the vice president would step up. But in a more ambiguous situation where the president is maybe unhinged, issuing crazy orders, things like that, they wanted some mechanism to displace the president, but they also wanted to stack the deck in favor of a president who says he's just fine. They wanted to make it very hard to displace a president in that situation, harder than impeachment would be. That's why you need two-thirds in the House and two-thirds in the Senate versus impeachment, where you only need a simple majority in the House and two-thirds in the Senate. So it's mainly for those situations where the president's completely incapacitated and can't respond.
I want to give a listen to a response to comments about the 25th Amendment. This is Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee on CBS Face the Nation, saying, hey, I want to hold a hearing based on this comment about the 25th Amendment.
There's an allegation by the acting FBI director at the time that the deputy attorney general was basically trying to do an administrative coup, take the president down through the 25th Amendment process. The deputy attorney general denies it. So I promise your viewers the following, that we will have a hearing about who's telling the truth, what actually happened.
The 25th Amendment presidential removal process described as an administrative coup. Is that a fair analogy?
I would not have used that term. I think that it's worth figuring out what was going on and who said what and who's telling the truth. And the fact that they didn't go through with it indicates that they realized that the support wasn't there to meet the very high standard. But if it were, if the president were doing something that the vice president, a majority of the cabinet, two-thirds of the House, two-thirds of the Senate, following a procedure set out in the Constitution, agreed meant that the president was not able to do his job to fulfill his functions, that's not a coup. That's following the Constitution. The framers were very worried about a coup, about disloyal cabinets, disloyal vice presidents. That's why they made it so hard to successfully invoke Section 4 over the objections of a president.
Talking to Brian Cult, law professor at Michigan State University, author of Constitutional Cliffhangers, a legal guide for presidents and their enemies. Getting back to the 60 Minutes interview, former acting FBI Chief McCabe told 60 Minutes he thinks he was fired last March because he opened a case into what he called a possible inappropriate relationship between President Trump and Russia. Here's a listen.
It's many of those same concerns that cause us to be concerned about a national security threat. And the idea is, if the president committed obstruction of justice, fired the director of the FBI to negatively impact or to shut down our investigation of Russia's malign activity and possibly in support of his campaign, as a counterintelligence investigator, you have to ask yourself, why would a president of the United States do that?
Now, Brian, you wrote a whole book on kind of what ifs of the Constitution as it relates to the president. Did you see this kind of situation coming? Concerns that, hey, maybe there's a president, at least according to this former FBI official, that might be shutting down an investigation related to himself?
Sure. This was something that the framers of the Constitution discussed at the Constitutional Convention. How much power do we give the president? Because he manages the executive branch, what happens when they're investigating him? What do we do? And the answer that they gave might not be satisfying to some people, but the answer that they gave was, the president is the president, and the checks on him while he's president are political. And in an extreme case, there's the possibility of impeachment, but the president has the ability to really slow things down if that's what he wants to do. If he's willing to pay the political price for it, after he's president, once he's left office, there is the potential to prosecute him for it. So he might be taking some risks that way, but the reality is the president does have a lot of power under the Constitution to protect himself, and the framers of the Constitution set up impeachment as the check for that. You can query whether that works, whether that's a good idea, but that is the system we have.
And I know you've thought about this issue a fair amount. To what extent can the president pardon him or herself for crimes that they might be charged with after they leave office?
Yeah, that's chapter two of my book. there's not a clear answer. The president can try. I would say, if I were the judge, that a self-pardon is not valid, because a pardon inherently is something you give to someone else, that principles that people shouldn't be above the law would apply. But there are some arguments on the other side, too. So we'd say the president could try, but it would be a very desperate president who would try that, a president with nothing to lose, maybe on his way out of office anyway. I think there's good reason to think that it wouldn't work. Maybe it would. Maybe it would be worth trying anyway. But it's important to note that he would not be able to protect himself using his pardon power from state prosecutors. So there's that possibility, too.
And very briefly, as we wrap up, getting back to the 25th Amendment, is that 25th Amendment part four a solution for the removal of the president, something that you think would be appropriate if everything President Trump was accused of were true?
No, I think the point of Section 4 is about physical, mental inability. If the problem is that the president has done bad things, then impeachment is the way to go. And Section 4 was designed to be harder than impeachment so that it wouldn't be used as an end run around impeachment. Impeachment requires just the majority of the House, two-thirds of the Senate, to say, well, let's get the cabinet, let's get the vice president, let's get even more of the House on board. It makes it harder. And I think it's not a good fit. It's not what the framers of the 25th Amendment wanted.
Thanks to Brian Kalt, law professor at Michigan State University, author of the book Constitutional Cliffhangers. We've been talking about former acting FBI chief Andrew McCabe's interview on 60 Minutes last night and the 25th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Sixty years ago today, music history was made. On this day in 1959, Ray Charles recorded his legendary hit, What Did I Say? The single became his first gold record, despite being banned on many radio stations for being too racy. And the song has an unusual backstory. Ray Charles made up the song on the spot just to fill time. As reported on the History Channel website, Ray Charles and his band were playing a show in Pittsburgh. Their contract said they had to play for 4 hours. But with 10 minutes left in the show, they were all out of songs. So Ray Charles says he started noodling on the keyboard and came up with that famous riff we just heard. Then he made up some lyrics along the way, and then he started having his backup singers echo what he was singing. Got a great response. He says, quote, "Then I could feel the whole room bouncing and shaking and carrying on something fierce." He added the song to his regular set and then called Atlantic Records and said, "Hey, maybe we ought to record this." Not bad to have that much gas in your tank after 3 hours and 50 minutes to come up with this song. More Ray Charles here on Central Time. Tell me what I say right now.